All right, we're in CLR world, and this is the face of the CLR in some sense. Who are you?
My name's Ian Carmichael. I'm the general manager now, responsible for the .NET Core platform, and I've been with Microsoft and the CLR team since I joined Microsoft almost 10 years ago now. I've kind of been doing this stuff my whole time, one way or the other.
So, I mean, I guess the first question is, I mean, it's been 10 years, right? And now you guys are at V4. When you look back, are you just like, wow, man? Yeah,
I think in some ways the wow man piece for me is just, you know, in a lot of ways just how many customers we got building on top of this thing today. And you know, if you pick a piece of it, you know, pick C# as a language, for example, it isn't very often in the industry that a new language comes along that actually gets, you know, kind of broad adoption. And I kind of think of the whole V1 effort and the context we were in, I think a lot of us kind of see it as kind of a piece of the mainstream. But there certainly was a point in time when, you know, there were questions in everybody's mind about, hey, would we actually be successful? Would it take off? Would folks be delighted with what we were building? And say, when I look back over the whole time, I think that's it's a pretty amazing ride in that sense. And just kind of seeing from where we started, you know, when it was kind of no code and kind of, you know, hey, maybe we should, you know, have something that, you know, does something kind of like this to kind of where we are today. That's a pretty amazing trip.
Absolutely. Yeah. Awesome. And you guys are definitely innovating in that space as well, right?
I mean, yeah, and so, in a lot of ways, for us, the first release, like I said, you know, kind of starting from nothing, you've kind of got a pretty clear picture of where you want to go, at least for that. It's kind of got to run code at the end of the day. You got to let somebody write code and actually run a program, and so that in and of itself kind of lays out a bunch of work you kind of just have to go do. Mm. And then what's interesting then is you kind of finish that, and you kind of get a few things left over that you wanted to get done, so that kind of lays out the next piece. Then you kind of get to this place and says, okay, great, now we got a platform. It does a lot of stuff, and it does a lot of stuff pretty well. So now what?
Yes.
It kind of becomes the next question. And so, you know, when you kind of think about what you do well as a platform and kind of other things that maybe you could do well, and you kind of have this choice between, okay, I can make what I got better, or I can start to look at new spaces and kind of say, hey, you know, is there something of value here that's of value someplace else as well?
Excellent.
And so that's what kind of brings us into, anyways, kind of a bunch of the innovation that's happened over that period of time has been looking at, okay, it works pretty well over here. Let's pick, you know, in our second release, one of the big examples was, hey, what about doing stored procedures inside the database, for example? And you kind of start with, okay, that's actually, for a lot of folks that program in .NET, a lot of that has to do with, you know, talking to a database anyways. And so there are some places where it would actually be awful nice to be able to write a stored procedure in a language of my choice and with some of the performance characteristics that the runtime has. So what does it mean for us to run inside that environment, particularly when you want to run in process? And so we had to go, when you look at the reliability and scaling requirements of running in a server process like that, for us in our second release, it sounds like a simple thing, but there was an amazing amount of engineering that went place through this team on looking at, you know, every single allocation in the code base, and are we, you know, robust to failure in that context. When you talk about wanting to run on, at that time it was 32 processors, was kind of a high-end machine.
Yeah.
You know, how do you get a garbage collector that actually scales efficiently all the way through 32 processors and kind of tackling those kinds of things? And so those are, anyway, so that's an example of when you take a new problem space and say, hey, we'd like to kind of extend this idea that folks can use the tools of their choice and the language of their choice, kind of wherever they want to program, at least as an option. How do we make the platform more applicable and kind of the at least an option for folks that want to choose it, or kind of, you know, a good tool of choice for a bunch of these other problem domains. And so in a lot of ways that's kind of been about, you know, and kind of that sort of story repeated over the years has been, if we want to allow folks to program everywhere, how do we, you know, we can go take a look at another one and say, okay, maybe we're not great there yet, and how do we actually go make something that's great in that space as well?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one clear example would be when you guys built the initial CLR, you baked the static type system into the machine, right? And so everybody was writing static languages, C#, static language. And then, of course, you see the industry starting to adopt and love the dynamic world, and so it was almost impossible to write dynamic languages on top of the CLR early on. So you guys created the DLR.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say almost impossible. Just a lot of engineering had to go.
I'd say it was hard to do it well. was the way I would say it, actually, as far as the early days. And so we actually had a level of desire that from day one when we built this thing that it, I'd say our focus in our first release was primarily on, you know, making sure we did the static languages very well. But it's always been a desire that it be a, it be a platform that supports more than just static languages. I think there were some broad early failures, I would say, because we hadn't made it easy enough for a language implementer to use the platform for dynamic language. And that's actually where the DLR starts from. Actually, it was a project of Jim Hugenin's that actually, I don't know, you've probably talked with Jim at some point, but he set out to kind of figure out how Microsoft could have got the platform so bad. Right, that you know we couldn't do dynamic languages, so he started with the port of Python, having done the similar activity with JVM, and actually came to the opposite conclusion. He was going to write a pithy paper about how badly we sucked, and at the end of the day, he decided actually maybe it doesn't suck so bad, and he ended up coming here to Microsoft to work on the thing.
Sure.
And that Jim was actually one of the first folks to work on the DLR when he came here, and a lot of the ideas behind the DLR piece came from Jim when he joined here. I'd say we're and that's another space where I think we've got a start that I think is a very good start. It's another space where I think we also have a lot of work to do still. And so we're going through, I'd say, you know, you'll see us over the next couple of years really work hard on making sure we've got a great lightweight tooling story. If you want to talk about dynamic languages in a script context, there's many places where you'd like something a little lighter weight for being able to program with script. That's not necessarily sort of the professional developer that wants everything that Visual Studio offers, and so I'd say that's a place we still have to tackle a little bit. And then we know we've still got Jim's done some great work on top of the CLR, and we're now at a point where we're going back and doing a second turn of the crank and saying, okay, if we open up the hood again and take a look inside, now that we've got Jim's thing, you know, kind of built, he's kind of pushed the limits. Okay, what can we do on top of CLR? We got time now to go back and say, okay, are there intrinsics? We don't need to, you know, bake everything in, but we're taking a look at, you know, kind of, and a lot of this work goes back a long way to self and, you know, current JavaScript implementations, and, you know, people have been doing this for a long time. But when you look at the things that make some of these dynamic languages really efficient, are there some things that can only, or are better done if we kind of say, okay, now we're going to make a couple of changes, and we're going to put some more smarts in the JIT or into the code generation. What's been interesting was how successful Jim was with no changes. But even that said, there are some places where we know we can get faster still if we lift up the hood and change a few things on the inside.
Excellent.
And so we've been spending a bunch of time internally anyways looking at exactly what would that look like. And that'll be something that we definitely, I don't know when, but we're definitely going to see some improvements down the road from this.
Cool. So, I mean, you know, of course, all of us have read, we remember the days of Chris Broom and his epic blog posts, some of them which got him in trouble. But a brilliant guy, and he, you know, one of the things that I remember, one of his best blog posts, not one of his best, but one I really enjoyed reading, was on exceptions, and sort of the exception model and the CLR and how he really wanted to change it. So here we are at V4, and there's, you know, how are we doing in that aspect of a machine? And so, that's a very vague question, but...
So maybe I can kind of take that two ways. There's kind of some of the specifics around exceptions where... But also in general, just, you know, after 10 years, you kind of look back and you say, okay, maybe there's a couple things we... if we had it to do all over again, you know, maybe not this one and maybe not that one. Now, the challenge for us is we've been successful as a platform. We've got an awful lot of customers that depend on this stuff.
Sure.
And so it's certainly a different world from, you know, when we're building this for the first time, when you kind of have this, you know, this kind of empty playing field, and you kind of, I can do it this way, do it that way, you know, it's kind of a conversation in the hallway. And we're long beyond those days, and so any changes we kind of look at through the system, we have to be enormously thoughtful about who are our current customers, you know, their existing investment. There's millions and millions of lines of, we have individual customers with millions of lines of
awesome of
code on top of the stuff. But that, there's an enormous responsibility that comes with that says, well, we're not going to take the exception system that we built, even if Chris and I used to have these debates, you know, kind of way back in the day. And I've got my own pieces of mail from Chris saying, you know, I'm not quite sure this is exactly where we'd like to land it. Yeah. Much of those conversations, I think, kind of, you know, they're not on the table anymore. We build something, and it's pretty good.
Yeah.
And so in a lot of these things, the conversation is not, do we do something different? It's about where do we refine, and where do we make things better in somewhat more, usually somewhat more subtle ways to make it easier, to make something simpler to do that's not simple to do today, to make something possible that's not possible, but it certainly changed the nature of the design work too, where you're, and in some ways it's harder.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to strike that balance across, gee, there's something we'd like to do, and yet there's existing code out there. So there's, but then you can kind of go through the list, and I think any space we've done since V1 that's been part of kind of the fundamentals, whether it's exception handling or interoperability with native code and how you call back and forth between, you know, C# and Windows or COM, and you kind of just look at, you know, we had something pretty good in V1, and yet there's been ways we can make a bunch of these things easier or more reliable or more flexible or provide more real opportunities for folks. And so that's been a big part of whether it's exception handling or interop or any of these spaces is how do you keep what you got and respect your preserve your existing customers' investment and still, you know, make some new things possible in all these spaces to make things easier for people.
Absolutely. I mean, in some sense, it could be that, you know, that virtualization rides in on a, you know, on a horse and saves the day and lets you innovate out of your mind at the same time being able to support using, you know, virtualization primitives, if you will, to take care of dealing with the old legacy world. But that's kind of science fiction, but this could be an approach that we...
It could be, but I don't want to think of... We're certainly not at a place where I want to, you know, take what we got and say, oh, there's an old legacy world and there's going to be a brave new world. So I think when you look at compatibility in some places, I mean, sometimes we end up with just, we made things faster and, you know, unfortunately, you know, there's some bug someplace else in the system, not even in our code sometimes, where just the simple act of making something faster breaks an application at the end of the day. There's other cases where, you know, you get applications that are dependent on things that you go back and you look at and go, wow, I kind of hope that nobody ever really was never intended to be something that was true. Take a look at UI examples around, you know, order delivering messages and that kind of stuff, where there never really was a promise or a contract from us that said we'd give you this message before that one instead of that one before this one. But you end up with applications that
rely that,
you know,
on
kind
that.
Of break. And this is the same problem that Windows has at the end of the day. And so this is a more fundamental thing that says even when we innovate in a really compatible way and we're really thoughtful about being careful about it, when you get enough stuff and there's just enough applications and enough code that's built on top of you, at the end of the day, you can kind of count that any kind of weird corner case, somebody's someplace, you don't know who necessarily, but somebody someplace is kind of depending on that wacky behavior. And I think that, for me at least, when we kind of look at virtualization, and it has some other attributes as well that are kind of nice, but that's more the place when I think about, you know, how do you really make sure that no matter what you do, you know, kind of something's not... You know, you don't cause an impact for somebody. It has to do with those cases where when we fix a bug in our code and somebody's dependent on that behavior, then, you know, hey, we want to have this bright divide where, no, we didn't like the way we did, you know, exceptions, and we'll go to that completely differently. I think that it makes it much tougher for, I got a big code base and I want to move forward and take advantage of the newest things. That has to be an easy thing for people to do.
Agreed.
And so, you know, to the extent that we make that difficult for our customers, it's not good for any of them. And so that's all part of the balance at this point around, you know, kind of doing the new. And it's something we're spending a lot more time than we ever have, is, you know, thinking really hard about, even in you know, kind of managed code now, there's just a lot of stuff. So how do we manage app compat programs? We spend a lot of time collecting applications now, pulled in. It's, you know, a lot of the things I'm talking about are, you know, it starts to look and feel a bit like Windows with some of the same challenges. You know, big API service, a lot of applications built on top of it, a lot of customers with the current investment. So I think some of the problems actually end up being very similar, and some of the solutions at the end of the day are going to be very similar too.
Interesting. let's look back a little bit. I mean, remember when we first released the CLR, the whole thing was, and even Don Box gave a talk at PDC03, that COM is dead, and the whole thing about, you know, native code versus managed code and all this stuff. But in reality, it seems that native code and managed code is now, they're both evolving nicely now. Whereas it used to be the C++ team over building 41, 40, were spending their time trying to figure out how to interoperate with you guys. Now they're evolving their own language. So it's sort of like we've come back down a little bit, and both languages are evolving, both platforms are evolving. What's your take on, like, the future of native code? And do you ever think there will be a day when just most people are writing managed code?
I'm going to let my phone finish ringing. No, I don't think there's going to be a day when everybody's writing managed code. I don't think it's let's talk about a couple of things through this space. I do think we're bringing our own thinking back to at least as far as the message of PDCs and kind of the rest of it, back to an important place, a more balanced place. And if I kind of just pick the simplest thing, let's talk about C and C++. So we were just talking about folks with, you know, kind of millions of lines of C#. Mm-hmm. There's also applications out there with tens of millions, if not more, lines of C code. Mm-hmm. That, frankly, it works pretty darn well. And sometimes that's the core of a huge part of an application. And, you know, like any big piece of software, you know, there's value in if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Sure.
And so I think there's, pick a big application, there's not a whole lot of value in just, you know, why would I go back and rewrite 10 million lines of perfectly good code? It's not going to bring me any business value at the end of the day. So that's part of the context. And we're seeing this in more and more customers, is that they're actually shipping solutions where there's substantial asset in the unmanaged code, and, you know, places where managed code also is an important part of the solution that they provide at the end of the day. And I think particularly when you get to a lot of these really big applications at the end of the day, are not only an end-user application, but also a platform in their own right. And so I've got all this stuff, mm-hmm. but if it's a platform as well, programmable, like, you know, pick Photoshop's got its own scripting piece built in. If you take Esri, they do kind of anything that's got to do with a map, you know, they've got their own developer ecosystem, just like Microsoft has developed ecosystem. Those guys have a developer ecosystem. And so, of course, they also want to be able to reach out to all the .NET developers, and so it's important to them to have a .NET surface. But it doesn't mean they need to rewrite all their stuff in order. They just need to... It's where the interoperability piece comes in, and so important. They need to be able to have a first-class native experience, but they also want to have a first-class managed experience for their developers that want to choose to use managed tools for writing their solutions on top of their platform. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big part anyways, and I think we've seen an increasing trend of mixed applications where there's some old stuff that I'm going to leave the way it is, there's some new stuff. For some of the parts of my new stuff, I want to choose to use managed code. But I'm not a big fan of the kind of, you know, it needs to be one or the other kind of approach. Mm-hmm. There's still a place in the world for assembler, you know, and C and C++ and other languages and scripting languages. These things are all tools at the end of the day.
Agreed.
And my view on a lot of this stuff is, as engineers at the end of the day, we should know our tools and we should pick the right tool for the job.
Agreed.
And, you know, a lot of what we're doing is looking at, okay, are there some places where we can offer better tools than we have today, whether it's on the native side or the managed side, to put a few new tools in your box and give you a few more choices at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. But I kind of feel like it's, you know, kind of our job to provide great tools. And then if you're going to write software, you know, we should help you understand what the tools do, where they work, where they don't work, so that you can make good engineering choices for whatever it is that you want to do. And, you know, not try to jump too much into the latest hype or the latest fad, but to allow everybody to kind of make good decisions about what problem it is they're trying to solve and what tools the right choice.
Agreed. That's awesome. I mean, of course, you know, verifiability is a great thing, man. Type safety and all that nice stuff that you get free, virtually, in the CLR world.
And there are lots of places where that provides enormous benefit. Mm-hmm. There are many problem domains. There are many problem domains where you must have verifiability. So if you're talking about wanting to, any kind of place where you want to run code from somebody else on your PC. You have to have an isolation boundary of some sort, one way or the other. And there's a couple of ways to achieve that. Some of them involve, you know, using something that looks and feels like a process box or virtual machine, and there's some places where that's a good choice for how I take codes from somebody else and isolate it. And there are other places where I really do want to run code from somebody else and I want to have a lighter weight sandbox because I want high performance or I want fidelity across those boundaries. And so if you look at inside the browser, there's lots of good examples where, you know, I actually do want to run something. And today it's done inside the browser and, you know, our virtual machine or somebody else's virtual machine. But those kinds of scenarios, many of them are best done with the virtual machine inside a process, and that's the place where if you don't have verifiability, there's some esoteric stuff that's kind of out there on the bleeding edge, but today, if you don't have verifiability, you don't have a solution for how to do that well.
Absolutely. Now, I interviewed Lars Bak, the
yes.
V8 creator.
Yes.
And, you know, we it was a long one. It was me, Eric Meyer, and Lars, and he was, you know, really generous in explaining to us what he was doing, what he was thinking. After that conversation, actually towards the end of the interview, we started arguing a little bit about the usefulness of intermediate bytecodes generally. And so he was, you know, he made comment after the interview. We were kind of arguing. I mean, I had the position of, well, you know, IL is a good thing because it helps with tooling and various other things. But he was adamant about it's completely unnecessary. Go from source code right to machine code, that's fine. So I want to ask you about, you know, what's so important? Why, you know, what's the big deal with MSIL?
Why have that? So there's lots forever. There's been lots of systems that have chosen to have a bytecode representation in them, going all the way back to, I don't know, early Pascal systems and the rest of them. They've been around forever. I think if you look in our context, you kind of say, why have an intermediate form? This one may not matter so much in the JavaScript world.
Sure.
But in a place where if you and me program in different languages, mm-hmm. but we want to be able to interchange pieces so that what I write can be easily called by you and what you write can be easily called by me, we have to have a common intermediate language. Otherwise, I'm speaking one language and you're speaking another and our code can't talk to each other. I'd say that's the simplest place where having a common IL representation that says, okay, my language is going to get bubble down to this thing, and your language is going to get bubbled down to this thing. It means that I can take code written by, I don't need to be a C# programmer to use a library that's written by somebody in C#. I can be a VB programmer and get access to that, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's that actually was a key part of why IL was in the system from the beginning, is we wanted to build a runtime system that supported a large number of languages, and to separate the language choice from the library infrastructure, so that you didn't have to, you didn't have to pick these two things together, and we didn't have to, you know, build a different library for this language and that language and everything else. And that's been one of the pieces actually that's been enormously successful, has been this, you know, the separation of the library service from the language, and. You know, if you kind of go back and, you know, we had C# and VB, but they had different intermediate forms, so we'd have to have a whole library for VB that was different from the library for C#.
Yeah.
Or if you want to not have that, then you've got to have something that's a common form in the middle. So that's an example.
Sure.
where it kind of comes into play. Now, if you're just doing a simple script engine where you're trying to take JavaScript and make it run as fast as you can, and that's the only problem domain you've got, it's not clear that going to IL in the middle of that necessarily is buying you a lot. And, that's, frankly, that's one of the things we're going to have to look at as we go down this road ourselves. We're not, certainly not there yet, but when you say, hey, we're talking about dynamic languages and script, and, you know, one of the things we're going to probably come back to take a look at in the next year is specifically for script, and only for script, Do we want to carve out a faster path from the, you know, kind of the higher level piece to some of our lower level internal representations that gets us from here to there without going through the bytecode? And we might choose for some script scenarios when we get a chance to finish measuring that and looking at it to end up with something that's closer to where Lars is at as far as not using a bytecode representation in between. And I think that's a good example of of, you know, when it kind of talking about going after a new domain and wanting to be world-class in a new domain.
Sure.
If that's getting in the way of us being great there, then, you know, we'll figure out how to not have that get in the way at the end of the day. So we're not down to having made a decision about whether that's going to be in the way or not.
Sure.
We're doing some work. We're going to go measure and, you know, make some decisions.
But, excellent.
Anyways, that's all part of going after new space. So Lars is right that there certainly are places where you... It's not necessarily buying a lot of value. There are other scenarios where you absolutely want to have it. It's a good thing to have.
Excellent. So let's talk a little bit now about the future of the CLR.
Yeah.
Like when you think about, without getting into specifics, et cetera, so PR doesn't freak out on us. But I mean, what, you know, this is your baby, right? You're the GM. When you look out at the future, what are you thinking? What directions are we
going? So if I take, you know, releases and time frames and I, you know, caveat all this with I'm not making any promises about
yes
kind of beyond we've already talked to the team about before.
Absolutely. Which is great, by the way.
Give me a sense of just kind of, you know, what's front of mind for me anyways in terms of where I think we have more to do versus where we are today as far as really making our customers successful. I think let me start with one, which is just we talked a little bit about how large the surface has grown. I'd say for client applications, say the deployment experience, when the version of the framework I choose to use is not currently on Windows, is not nearly as lightweight as it needs to be. And so I think there's, we've done some work already in this release in terms of, you know, factoring between, there's a client footprint in 4 that's kind of about 20 megabytes is kind of roundabout where we're hoping to land this thing for the 4.0 release. As kind of the smallest piece you can deploy if it's not already on the box, but it's still bigger than it should be. Mm-hmm. And really, in a lot of ways, I got an app, and the pieces of usually the case is the piece of the framework I'm using, I feel like I'm getting good value for those. But as the framework gets big, if I got to deploy the whole thing, what you're actually asking me to do as an application is to deploy parts of the framework that I'm actually not using in my app.
Exactly.
If it's not on the machine. And so I think we have to do much more on our side around allowing you as an application not to pay, to be happy that, you know, I feel like I'm getting good value for what I'm using, but not to have to also pay for the pieces that I'm not using out of the framework. And I think there's, so that's going to take us down a road that says we need a better pay-for-play style system.
Mm-hmm.
Where I can get something that's, where when I deploy a client application in particular, it's smaller and lighter weight, cleaner and easier on the machine. And we've made some good steps through this release, but I think there's quite a lot of work for us to do there over probably more than one release. I'd say over the next couple of releases to really get to where we'd ideally like to be, where everybody's got a great story around that. I think what else is front of mind? We talked about dynamic languages already.
Mm-hmm.
That's obviously a space where we're thinking hard about, you know, what kind of investments would we make to kind of make us better still there. I think we have work to do in as you start to tackle other problem domains, scientific.
Mm.
I think that's another space where, whether it's at the library level, I think the F-sharp guys are doing some great work at the language level, but there's runtime level. I think it's another space where there's just uncharted territory to kind of go into as far as where the framework is at and kind of what's still ahead of us there. And then you kind of just keep going back to fundamentals, I think, is the other one for us, is you know, how do we keep making interop better between managed and native?
Mm.
How do we... performance, another great one. Mm-hmm. I think we've done an enormous amount of work, particularly if you kind of look at where we've landed with client apps with 3.5 SP1, and you compare sort of a Java app on the client to a framework app on the client. We've done an awful lot of work around, particularly making that startup... that initial, how long does it take me from when I click on an app, my desktop, to actually have the application launched. We've done an awful lot of work there. But that's you kind of never get, you never run out of, gee, we could, you know, find a way to make this thing go faster and to actually have that provide value for people. And especially as the engine that's at the bottom of all of this software.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any couple of percents, you know, whatever it is at the end of the day, it's for everybody.
Mm.
Right, and so it's a place we make investments down here, knowing that, you know, every few percent we are able to make down at the level of the engine room, you know, it's another 5% that nobody up the stack has to go find because we just made it go faster for them.
That's awesome.
And so that's, you know, it's the cool part about being at the bottom. It's a challenging part, too. I mean, sometimes you get, I mean, these guys go faster and those guys go slower.
Yeah.
Those are tricky on the balance at times. But nonetheless, it's you know, it's performance is kind of never-ending job. You got to walk through a bunch of the other basics. And we'll, you know, we usually go back through every release and say, is there more we should be doing on this, that, or the other piece? What else is kind of on the list? You know, there's... If you kind of climb up the stack, I think there's more work to do in libraries at various levels. I think there's, I think we started some interesting work this release with contracts that allow folks to kind of, it's kind of like an assert on steroids in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But kind of make some stronger promises about, hey, this is the way my API should be used. I think there's, I think that's the foundation for something that creates better tooling over the long run. There's a lot of, road to run there to kind of further create better experiences for folks around catching kind of common programming errors, you know, kind of usage of APIs at compile time that we might not be doing today. And so that's all part of making folks more productive. If you look at tooling, there's, particularly when it comes to multi-core and parallelism, there's, you know, there's a lot of nice things we could do to make it easier for people to kind of, you know, find bugs for them, spot errors for them, the rest of it. And so those are all areas, anyways, where there's kind of this nice green field where you can kind of look at it and go, okay, where we are is not necessarily bad, but we kind of look at that and go, you know, but we could do better, and you know, really make a big difference for folks. And those are all examples of spaces that are kind of front of my mind, anyways, around, yeah, we can go do better for here, and we can, you know, keep moving this thing forward and make things better over time.
Because, I mean, it would be interesting. I mean, I don't think many people think about, you know, what it means to, say, be running on a system with 1,000 cores, right, or 1,000 processors. Now, assuming that those, you know, the Intel geniuses and AMD geniuses figured out how to deal with caching problems, if you had 1,000 cores, you know, that means something for something like the CLR, right? I mean, you have so much that could be done to take advantage of that and help those of us way up on top of the libraries program against it, which, of course, the PCP team is doing. But I've always had the kind of a question, like, so you have the PCP people who are approaching it very excellently from the compositional aspect for developers. But down at the low level of the machine, certainly there's things that you guys can do with thread management and garbage collection and stuff like that to ensure that we're taking full advantage of these ridiculously powerful systems. And, of course, you guys are doing that. I mean, you're kernel developers, in essence, right?
Well, I don't want to take anything away from the kernel developers, but in a lot of ways, yes, a lot of the low-level issues we have to deal with are similar to what you have to deal with in the low-level of the level of an operating system. If you want to talk about that space for a minute, like, that's, you know, it's... So the fact we're getting these cool, you know, highly symmetric, you know, multiprocessor machines, you know, it's a fascinating transition that's going to happen over the next, you know, well, period of time, right? Mm-hmm. Can't make these things go faster, but we can stick more cores on a single die, so we're going to do it. And so that gives us immense processing power. Mm-hmm. And the question is, great, so how do you best, you know, take advantage of that all the way from the low-level engine guys all the way up through, frankly, somebody who's really doesn't want to have to do anything with that. And the truth is, as soon as you... There's a wonderful simplicity to single-threaded programming at the end of that. There really is. Yeah. And there's a lot of problems for which, you know, I really would just like to write single-threaded and have that be good enough. Mm. And, you know, if I'm going to write a bunch of script inside Office, I probably don't want to express any parallelism there at the end of the day. I probably just got 15 things I want to automate, and that's great. I don't want any more than that. And so, and you know, UI programming is simpler if you don't have to deal with this, and you don't have to worry about race conditions and all, you know, all those kinds of things. And so there's a level at which, you know, kind of, you know, you'd like to kind of take advantage of that stuff without, you know, kind of exposing any of that complexity out to people. And so how do you first, you know, do the work under the hood And then as you kind of climb down the stack, then you start to say, okay, well, great for somebody who wants to take the next step. You know, what are the steps we can create through that so that there's, you know, I can get, you know, a little more power with a little more learning, and, you know, a lot more power with a lot more learning. And you know, this is the fascinating place, too, where language comes back in. And it's such an intrinsic, simple thing. And it's, you know, come back to kind of talk about the multi-language idea, but the ways we give people to express themselves as programmers, particularly around parallel, this is enormously important, but I think it's true in general, you know, it really affects the way we think about, you know, programming problems at the end of the day.
Mm.
And so if you look at the work that the PCP team has done around, you know, creating these, you know, simple idioms around parallel fours and parallel twos and the rest of it, just the fact I can write it cleanly,
mm-hmm.
And not only write it, but somebody else who picks it up and looks at it, it's expressed in a way where it's immediately obvious to me what the intent was of, you know, kind of the person that wrote this code, and it's not, you know, kind of hidden behind a bunch of other things that you kind of got to, you know, try and find the forest for the trees around some of these things.
Sure.
Sometimes. That's an enormously, enormously powerful thing. And so this is a space where I think we'll see some kind of coming down levels. A fair bit of language innovation over the next period of time as, you know, we really do a fair bit more to allow programmers to express their intent in a clean way on parallel machines. And that's where you're seeing a lot of the work that's kind of going on, not just the PCP team, but some of the parallel link work, some of these other things. Really, that's what this is about, is making it easy for you as a programmer to say what you want, to communicate your intent to both the machine and to another human looking at this thing at the end of the day. And then when you get down to the hood, then we're busy trying to figure out, okay, how do I get, you know, we got a machine with a whole bunch of threads. How do we make that as efficient as possible? How do we minimize switching costs? How do we, how does the garbage collector take advantage of that stuff? What can we do for you,
mm-hmm.
so that even if you're not, you know, kind of worrying about parallelism yourself, that on a machine that's got a bunch of these cores, you're at least getting benefit from that, as much benefit as we can provide for you,
sure,
you know, for free, if you will.
Excellent.
So it's a big crazy space, and it's going to continue to be hugely important.
Green fields, man.
Yeah.
Sure. Cool. Well, hey, thank you for your time. I mean, CLR V4, it's come a long way. It's exciting. I mean, everybody's now, you know, the Niners have learned a lot about what you guys have done. I mean, innovation's all over the stack, all the way up in the VCL.
Mm-hmm.
Great stuff there. So we look forward to see how this is evolving. We'll come back and talk to you, you know, maybe the next release.
I would love to see you back here again.
All right.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Take care.